Matter before us is Hoffman versus the District Court, case number 60119. Are the parties ready to proceed?
We are.
Very well.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alice Mercado. I'm Clemens Grundy-Eisenberg, and I'm here to represent the petitioners, John Hoffman and Hoffman, Tess, Guinan, and Collier. And this is a writ proceeding that we have brought in which we are asking this court to issue a writ of mandamus directing the district court to enter summary judgment in favor of John Hoffman and his law firm on the legal malpractice claim that remains after the bifurcation of the equitable claims, because that claim is barred by the statute of limitations, as the equitable claims were found to be barred by the statute of limitations. NRS 11207 states that an action for malpractice must be brought within 4 years after the plaintiff sustains damages, or 2 years after the plaintiff discovers or through the exercise of reasonable diligence should have discovered the material facts that constitute the cause of action, whichever occurs earlier. Hoffman moved for summary judgment after the district court had ruled in the equitable portion of the bifurcated case that the facts which form the basis of the claims relating to the repayment of the $3.85 million loan were known or reasonably should have been known to Christian and Ann Buck after the July 18, 2002 meeting and when they filed their 2002 tax return. Those are the very facts that are the foundation of the legal malpractice claim. Under Awada versus Shuffle Master, the district court should have applied that same finding of fact and conclusions of law to the legal claim for malpractice. In fact, this was recognized by the Bucks. When they moved for bifurcation, they had stated, citing to Awada, that conducting a bench trial on the equitable claims prior to having legal issues decided by the jury is strongly preferred, if not required, if it is possible for the court to use its findings of fact and conclusions of law to dispose of the legal claims. It also reduces the possibility of confusion and delay. That is the statement made by the Bucks to the district court to seek bifurcation, and respectfully, that's exactly what the district court should have done in this case. It should have applied its findings, which pertained to, as it said, the claims relating to the insurance loan. The legal malpractice claim is exactly that. It is based on the insurance loan. Instead, what the district court did is that it ruled on our motion for summary judgment that there were issues of fact that remained. Respectfully, we disagree, because the facts that were needed to determine the discovery rule were already determined by the district court in the equitable proceedings. Two issues that I would like to address in this argument in the time that I have are the issues with regard to whether or not the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the client or claimant seeks independent counsel or seeks another attorney to get an opinion. And then the second issue that I think is important to decide in this matter is whether or not concealment has been established. What constitutes concealment for purpose of the statute of limitations in a legal malpractice case? And I submit that that is an issue of first impression out of this court, as the court has dealt with it in another context, but not in the context of a legal malpractice case. With regard to the two-year, whether or not the two-year discovery period was told until the claimant obtained independent counsel or obtained another attorney, I submit that the district court, in finding that that was an issue of fact, misread the cases of Charleston versus Hardesty and Gonzalez versus Stewart Title. Both of those cases are transactional legal malpractice cases, and in both of those cases, the court had said that the clock started to run, essentially, once counsel was sought, because in those cases, there were documents that were drafted that those were the issues raised in those cases. But the way that the court read it in this case was that it seemed to suggest that in a transactional malpractice case, the clock never starts to run until the client has sought independent counsel or sought another attorney to say, hey, do I have a case for malpractice? In light of this case, I would submit that that is incorrect. That is not a broadly stated rule by Charleston versus Hardesty or by Gonzalez. Those were facts that were limited to those cases. If the process or that principle were adopted by this court, then that would leave to the litigants the decision as to whether or not they can hold the statute of limitations. And that is not a policy that this court wants to adopt, to leave to a litigant the ability to manipulate the statute of limitations or to toll the statute of limitations until they decide, I'm going to go look for another lawyer. That's not what's contemplated by either of the cases that have been cited. And it's certainly not contemplated by the statute of limitations, 11.207, because those cases, like every statute of limitations, the policy is to encourage the quick disposition of cases, not to let them languish until a litigant decides, I'm ready to go seek counsel now. That is not the diligent prosecution that this court has anticipated. So in this case, with regard to whether or not the plaintiffs needed to go seek another attorney, the district court had already decided that they were on inquiry notice. So it didn't make sense for the court then to say the only way that they would know whether they have a claim for malpractice is by going to seek another attorney. So that really wasn't an issue of fact that would have precluded summary judgment in this case. So summary judgment should have been granted based on the fact that the district court had already decided that the facts that formed the basis of the claims that related to the repayment of that insurance loan had already been decided, that the Bucks knew about it on July 18, 2002, when Mr. Hoffman met with them and when they filed their tax returns, at which point they knew that that payment had been made on each of their tax returns. The second issue that I think is of importance here is the concealment issue. As has been argued in the briefs, it has been argued that because Mr. Hoffman didn't say, I have a conflict, or he didn't say, I'm representing somebody else, that by doing so, that he somehow concealed, and that concealment told the statute of limitations. That is not the type of concealment that is contemplated by subsection 2 of 11.207. As I stated earlier, this court hasn't decided the issue of concealment with regard to a legal malpractice case, but earlier this year it did decide the issue of concealment with regard to a medical malpractice case. And the tolling provision, what is referred to as the tolling for concealment provision, is virtually identical to the medical malpractice case. And the court said in that situation that the type of concealment that is required is an intentional act that is designed to prevent the litigant from pursuing their claim. And that is the Wynn versus Sunrise Hospital case.
Do you think there's any difference analytically in the attorney-client context, given the strong fiduciary obligations an attorney owes his or her client, between the Wynn case and this case?
I don't, Your Honor. And the reason being, the issue of the concealment has been dealt with by the U.S. District Court following the Wynn case. And they use that same analogy. That was a case where the law firm of Robinson Bellastegui had been sued, and one of the claims against it was, you had a conflict of interest, you should have told us you had a conflict of interest. And the court says that is not the type of concealment, that's not that misconduct affirmative act that requires that you're preventing the litigant from stopping at the courthouse door. So applying that same analysis, it's what is prevented. The two-part test is it an intentional act, and is that intentional act designed to prevent the party from seeking redress in the courts?
And let me put my question differently. Are attorneys held to a higher standard of disclosure than doctors because of the fiduciary relationship that historically has been seen as existing between an attorney and his or her client on concealment or disclosure?
I think that we are held to a higher standard, Your Honor, but I also believe that the concealment language is intended to prevent misconduct, not I forgot to tell you or I didn't have anything to tell you. To apply concealment as strictly being because you didn't tell me, the problem that creates is that what if the attorney never thought he did anything wrong? What if the attorney wasn't even thinking he was an attorney, which is exactly what's going on in this case. In this case, they're attacking Mr. Hoffman for not telling these plaintiffs that he had a conflict of interest, but he wasn't there as their attorney. He was there as the trustee of the CAI Trust. And as such, he was presenting information to them. I mean, in the court's order, the 2010 order, the district court makes specific findings as to what Mr. Hoffman said, what he told them, what he was trying to accomplish. Those are all factors that he laid it out. And so now, you know, we're here 2 years later, what they're trying to say is, well, no, you should have said, I represent your father. Well, they knew that. So that was not going to be an issue that was going to change the fact. He should have said, I have a conflict of interest. Well, he didn't have a conflict of interest because he wasn't there as their attorney. He was there as their trustee, and they knew that. So nothing that Mr. Hoffman did or any of the things that they're saying should have been said prevented these plaintiffs from proceeding on, and certainly did not preclude the district court from granting summary judgment because she had already found that the facts that formed the claims underlying the premium loan had already been established. So there's no issue of fact.
Ms. Mercado, yes? I don't see in the district court's order of September 19, 2011, on this summary judgment question, rejecting summary judgment on the basis of 11-2072. Did she articulate questions of fact concerning the subject of concealment?
She says, and I'm looking at page 569, 3 at 569, that in the context of this case, there's a question of fact, at least as to the issue of whether Hoffman's failure to reveal to petitioners that they could assert a statute of limitations defense upon the note and save themselves a payment, put them on notice that they were being or about to be damaged in a tangible way. Again, it goes back to the revelation issue, and I don't know if that's what she's alluding to, because that was the argument that was made. He didn't tell us this, and that told the statute of limitations. In fact, I submit to the court that it appeared that the focus was more on the concealment, therefore the Bucks recognized that there was an accrual, that the discovery period had expired, and so the focus is on the concealment.
So the concealed fact, or allegedly concealed fact, appears to be the very same fact that in the equitable order the trial judge said you already had information about.
Correct. And that is a problem.
That seems inconsistent.
That's why we raised the issue of it is precluded, and under AWADA, she should have applied that same finding to the legal malpractice case. There would be no reason to make it a question of fact.
So is there any other concealed fact that the trial judge said was a question of fact?
Your Honor, I cannot think of any other concealed facts that are referred to, and I will certainly look at that, but what the district court did is essentially adopted the arguments that were made by the Bucks, that we didn't know whether or not, we didn't know anything until we consulted with independent counsel, or we didn't know that there was a conflict of interest. She basically concluded, and I'm still looking at page 569, that there were still unresolved, unlitigated questions of fact regarding whether the petitioners knew or should have known about the facts that formed the basis of their claim against Hoffman for malpractice. Well, that is totally inconsistent with the finding that she had already made. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. McCullough. Mr. Solomon.
May it please the court. I'm Mark Solomon. I'm here representing the respondents, Christian Buck and Ann Buck Finn. First, I'd like to address, if I may, this concept that it was the same issue decided in the equitable decision that it was with respect to the malpractice, and somehow there's some type of issue preclusion. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why there can't be issue preclusion. First, the complaint had multiple claims against Mr. Hoffman, and the district court stayed the malpractice claim. The order, therefore, has not adjudicated all the rights and liabilities as to all the parties. And under Rule 54B, the district court is free to revise her last order at any time, subject to entry of final judgment. That has not been done. In fact, under NRCP 52B, we still have the opportunity to seek to amend those findings, make additional findings, as there's been no written entry of judgment, period, in this case. But on top of that, there's no finding in the September 10th, 2000 order that respondents knew or should have known that their attorney concealed erroneous and conflicted advice about the terms and enforceability of the premium loans. The issue, she decided, is that we should have known, because we were told, in her judgment, in 2002, that those premiums were not a gift. That's a totally different and separate issue about whether, now that he's told us it's a loan, that loans bear interest and the appropriate rate is 7%, whether that was bad advice, whether that was bad advice that he gave us based on a conflict and which he intentionally concealed because he was trying to help this other client, the more wealthy client, Mr. Leonard Buck. Now, we clearly alleged and we clearly can prove, we believe, and there's certainly an issue of fact, that Mr. Hoffman was, in fact, acting as our attorney at the time of these disclosures. He had been our attorneys. He had done the estate planning for both of my clients. He had represented them on every single matter they had up to that time, except for an automobile accident where he referred Chris Buck to another attorney. He represented them after that time, continually until 2007, which I think is very relevant because that's the first time my clients had reason not to believe and trust in the advice they had gotten.
What alleged concealed facts remain for litigation in the district court, assuming you're going to look at 207 subparent 2 for concealment?
Let me spit those out quickly, and then I'd like to go through them if I have time. Mr. Hoffman concealed from the respondents that they had a complete defense from paying the note because he considered, and he testified he considered, that the note or the loans were barred by the statute of limitations. And he also testified, either in the trial or in his deposition, that he did not disclose that statute of limitation defense to my clients because it was inconsistent with his plan. And his plan was to avoid gift tax, estate tax, or income tax liability as a result of these premium loans from being imposed upon his other client, Leonard Buck, or upon the estate of Helen Buck.
And is it your theory that the attorney-client relationship obligated him with respect to those disclosures in a way that was different from the alleged fiduciary relationship that was tried on this bifurcated proceeding?
I understand the question.
Sorry, it was inarticulate.
No, it was a very articulate question. It's obviously the reason we believe that the district court's decision, preliminary as it is wrong. As a trust and estate lawyer, I believe that Mr. Hoffman had concurrent obligations. When a trustee is also a lawyer, he's charged with all that knowledge, in my opinion.
But isn't that a dangerous position for you as an advocate because she found against you on that point?
Well, what she really found, in my opinion, if you read her order carefully and you compare it to the order denying summary judgment, is that my clients knew or should have known this was not, should have known this was not a gift because they were told, which is totally distinguishable from the other issues. And you can certainly argue, if I can argue both sides of the coin on your question, that yes, Mr. Hoffman did have obviously different duties. I mean, he had rules of professional conduct that he had to comply with in his capacity as attorney. My clients admittedly didn't even know about the CAI trust until they showed up for that meeting. Mr. Hoffman had been trustee for years and never told them about the existence of the trust or that they were beneficiaries. He told them at that meeting. They came there with the expectation that their attorney was calling them. He testified he did nothing to disabuse them of the fact that he was their attorney. He did nothing to say he was also representing Leonard Buck. He did nothing to explain this plan and the pluses and minuses and the fact that he has a conflict and they should go get independent counsel, all of which arise in his capacity as an attorney. Now, I can argue both sides again. I could say he should have done that as a trustee, and we certainly, if and when we get a final decision, intend to appeal back to this court on that issue if she sticks with it. We're hoping that at the end of the malpractice, we're made whole, and maybe we won't be up on appeal on that. I mean, that's possible. In any case, let me give you another thing. He concealed that he was representing conflicting interests and was trying to help Leonard at my client's expense. Because any way you analyze this transaction, Mr. Hoffman testifies I was doing this as a family matter. Well, you know, that's a horrible conflict to be in when you have a parent and children that have dramatically different financial interests with respect to how the decision is made. Yet without explaining that conflict, without telling them the pluses and minuses of going different direction, our theory is he told them nothing to dissuade them, intentionally told them nothing to dissuade them from trying to follow his plan, which was to help Leonard avoid all these taxes. He gave us absolutely no reason not to agree to that plan. He concealed, and this isn't even part of their briefs, and clearly could not have been decided and wasn't decided by the district court in the first order. He concealed from my clients, his concurrent clients with Leonard, that he had funded the marital trust with an unsecured promissory note, which was in violation of the terms of the trust, was against Hoffman's own advice, as found by the district court to Leonard, and he knew we were the remainder beneficiaries, he knew we were concurrent clients, he knew that that could damage us. And how did he know all that? Because just before Mr. Hoffman drafted the note that was used, even though he advised his client that was wrongful, he had been consulted by Leonard Buck about breaking the trust because Leonard didn't want my clients to be able to receive anything under the marital trust. He thought they had gotten enough, and he hadn't shown proper respect to his new wife. And he wanted to get all control of all the assets out of the marital trust into a revocable survivor's trust so he could use those assets for the benefit of himself and his spouse. He revealed nothing of that, and there's no mention of that in the order. Excuse me. Finally, also nothing in the order of September 2010 is that the fact that he concealed his duty to advise respondents to seek independent counsel under Rule 158 before they agreed to enter a business transaction with him, naming him as the manager of a new LLC that he had created in their name before he even met with them in order to sweep the rest of the policies and the proceeds away from the CAI trust into this new LLC. He named himself as manager without disclosing to my clients that even though they were the sole members of that new LLC, they couldn't terminate the LLC and they couldn't remove him by themselves. A totally unfair an unreasonable transaction in which he did not consult properly under Rule 158 and advise our clients to seek independent counsel. I'd like to amplify on those if I have time in a minute, but I'd like to get to the law a little bit. I'm certainly aware of the Wynn case on the tolling for concealment provision under NRS 41A097 subsection 3, and that this court held that in the context of that statute, it was an intentional act by one party that prevents or hinders a reasonably diligent person from timely filing suit. We submit that even if that is the sole meaning of concealment under that statute, or even 11 .207 subsection 2, we have genuine issues of material fact of whether or not Mr. Hoffman intentionally concealed things in order to help his client avoid this tax. But we submit...
Mr. Solomon, the judge didn't mention 2 through 4 of the list you provided.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm a little hard of hearing.
The judge did not mention items 2 through 4 of what you've recited to us today.
No, I think she did.
Of concealed facts in her order.
Well, I have her order. I think it does the preference clause, Your Honor.
Okay. Where do you see that?
She references it on page 3 that's what we're arguing, that those are the facts that we're proposing.
Right, but on page 7, the only concealed fact that she considers to be a question of fact is the first one, the statute of limitations.
Right, she didn't specifically go through each one of the ones that we said and validate or invalidate them. We submit on the next page, she just popped at least 2 obvious ones. I don't think that she ruled the other ones were not issues of fact. In fact, my impression from reading the whole order is she agrees that they are issues of fact that were never considered by her because of the way she handled the case. And so I don't think there's any affirmative ruling one way or the other on that. She just said, hey, there's at least one here, and if there's at least one, that's enough to deny summary judgment.
And you were about to argue when...
Yes, if I can, because I think
I interrupted you, but my question is...
I'm sorry?
My question is, if we were to do an opinion in this case and articulate a different standard for lawyers versus the ruling in Wynn, what would that opinion look like? And what would its analytics be?
Sure. I think it's very easy to answer that. I think the legislative history for NRS 11.207 suggests the distinction by itself. The minutes of the Assembly Committee on May 21, 1997 for AB 427 disclosed that the tolling for concealment provision, at least with respect to attorneys and accountants, which are both fiduciaries, was discussed to mean that instances of fraud or misrepresentation in the context of fiduciary relationship are constructive fraud. And I'll also say the text of, although the text is similar, the text of 11.207.2, where it states that the time limitation is told by concealment when an attorney conceals an act, error, or omission that he merely just should have known about as opposed to actually knew about, I believe that text means that concealment includes a non-intentional failure to disclose where the fiduciary has a duty to disclose that. I mean, if an attorney doesn't actually know about an act, error, or omission, how can his concealment of it ever be intentional? And I think that language itself suggests that when you have a fiduciary duty to disclose, it's tantamount to concealment, which is exactly what this court has ruled over and over and over again, starting with...
But you also have veterinarians in this statute. So
I'm sorry?
You also have veterinarians in this statute.
You do, but not in the passage that I quoted.
It was
a separate bill. But it's admittedly similar language.
But the same concealment language, you're looking at the legislative history. We have to interpret the statute. The statute applies equally to veterinarians as attorneys.
I agree. All I meant was when the context of attorneys or accountant came up, the dialogue in the minutes specifically referred to the fact that those are fiduciaries, and the concealment provision was designed to take care of situations where you have constructive fraud. That's what I meant by that.
So you would rewrite Wynn in this context to embrace constructive fraud type claims?
Yes, I'm sorry. Again,
I
went off on at the same time we talked.
You would revise the Wynn standard for the attorney-client context to embrace constructive fraud as opposed to just actual concealment?
I would, Your Honor, and this isn't the only state that has, the only Supreme Court that's so ruled. I mean, I have a series of cases I could have cited where other cases, other jurisdictions where they have a pure fraud, all it says is fraud and concealment, routinely interpret that to mean when a fiduciary has a duty to disclose, his failure to disclose that is within the ambits of a fraud and concealment for the very reasons this court's pronounced in a number of cases already.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon.
Is my time up?
It is.
All right, thank you.
Ms. Mercado.
I would like to bring to the court's attention the case that I mentioned earlier. It's Arnell versus Robinson, Bellastegui, Sharp, and Lowe. And that's at 2012 Westlaw 3886181, issued by Chief Judge Jones of the United States District Court. And in footnote 5 of that decision, he talks about why using the medical malpractice standard for concealment in an illegal malpractice case makes sense, and he provides the reasons. And one of those reasons is, we've already mentioned, the general language is the same. He also mentions that both statutes begin running from the date of discovery or injury. And then he also mentions that the legal malpractice statute was amended to conform to the same professional standard of the other professions. The other reason why this court should continue with using the Wynn analysis for legal malpractice is the Mellon treatise, the legal malpractice treatise on Mellon. He talks about concealment, and he states also that the affirmative act, that concealment contemplates an affirmative act by a lawyer to hide his misconduct, and that's section 23.14 of the Mellon treatise.
Could I ask you to, you have short time, comment on Mr. Solomon's argument that it's an interlocutory ruling in the district court that may yet be subject to change, A, and B, whether this case, given the Wynn case and the recent Robinson-Bellastegui case, should be decided by us on mandamus, given that predicate?
Your Honor, the order that was issued was in 2010. We are now at the end of 2012. It is a final decision at this point. The fact that it may change or that they may appeal it later does not change the fact that it is a final decision for purposes of issue preclusion. So I think that this court can issue mandamus, and mandamus is an appropriate remedy for the efficient administration of justice, and that would be the efficient administration of justice.
Answer your question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mercado. Thank you, Mr. Solomon. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess.